All right, Nicholas, we just got back from spring break. You've got to be still. Sorry, Simeon. He struggles. He wants to fidget. And your like knee is so tense. You're such a tense little monkey. Just chill.
Some of us don't do this every day.
Okay. All right. This is Sarah.
And this is Nicholas, and you're listening to Pantsuit Politics.
Welcome to another episode of Pantsuit Politics, where we take a different approach to the news. As you just heard, I'm here with my husband, Nicholas, who is filling in for Beth while she's on spring break. Welcome to the show, babe.
Thanks for having me. I'm really delighted to be here. This is my favorite podcast.
For those of you who are new here and haven't heard our origin story, Pantsuit Politics was Nicholas's idea. Or at least, I was writing a blog at the time, and he really, really kept insisting I should start a podcast. I don't know if Pantsuit Politics necessarily was your idea, but the idea that I should start a podcast certainly was.
That's true. I did not think that the blog platform captured your dynamic.
Oh, thank you.
Personality, and that you would have a great radio presence, so to speak.
Well, not to brag, but I did get most talkative in high school.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've heard that before. And then, you guys took this idea together, and it became something I couldn't have imagined.
Thanks, pal. Today, Nicholas and I are going to tackle some headlines at the top of the show. We're going to move on and do the mirror image of Beth and Chad's conversation and talk about the state of the Democratic Party. And then we're going to close the show talking about our recent vacation to Utah. But before we get to that, y'all, we are 2 weeks. 2 weeks out from the launch of our new book, Now What? How to Move Forward When We're Divided About Basically Everything. The book comes out on May 3rd. Nicholas, have you pre-ordered a copy?
No.
What?
But I will.
But
today. I'll do it today.
You better pre-order a copy.
But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't pre-order a copy. You should definitely pre-order a copy. You should have already pre-ordered a copy.
Yeah, for sure.
Don't be like me.
Don't be like Nicholas. This book is so precious to us, largely because it's very personal. We share a lot about our personal lives, Nicholas. There is a lot of you in this book.
I am terrified.
Did you know the book is dedicated to you?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the book is dedicated to you and Chad.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you.
You're welcome. You can pre-order now, which is essential to helping fulfill my totally arbitrary dream of becoming a New York Times bestseller. I know the system's rigged. I don't care. I want that before my name everywhere I go. New York Times bestselling author, Sarah Stewart Holland. Doesn't it sound nice?
It sounds nice. But when you kind of look deeper into like what it means, it kind of cheapens what it
is. Just shut up. Shut up. That's not true. It still sounds fancy, and that's what matters. What matters is what sounds fancy in life. That's our values.
Okay. Fair enough.
So please pre-order the book. It means the world to us. If you pre-order, you get a link to a live virtual launch party on May 3rd. Or if you're feeling real adventurous, you can join us in Waco on April 30th. Get the book a few days earlier. See us in person. Hang out with us and Clint Harp. It's going to be a party. It's going to be a party. So the links to all that is in the show notes. We hope you'll join us in Waco. If you can't, we hope you'll pre-order the book. More than one copy. You can pre-order the audiobook now. We're very excited about that. Do I cry on the audiobook?
Of course you do.
Of course I do. Of course I do.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting.
Before we get started, I did want to say that we are aware of just the horrific video coming out of Grand Rapids and the killing of Patrick LaJoya. Beth and I will get together and talk about that next week, but I didn't want an episode to go by without saying we saw this terrible news and we're sending all the love that we can to his family and to the people of Grand Rapids and the community there as they deal with this. So the top news of the week, I would say, was the shooting in the subway in New York City. We talked about it a little bit on the Good News Brief yesterday, which you joined me for, which was fun. Because there does seem to be, and it's not good news, but there's definitely like a lot of silver linings to this particular incident. It was scary. It was chaotic. It plays on everybody's worst fears about the subway. But while there were many people injured, no one has died or is expected to die from their injuries. The shooter is in custody. So it could have been... While it's awful, it could have been much worse.
Right. They did capture him yesterday, I think, late last night. He actually called in the tip line himself, and then he was captured, I think, a few hours later by the New York police.
I think it's just, you know, as the subway is trying to come back from COVID, which was not exactly a pleasant place to be when there's an airborne virus, there's also been a couple of people pushed in front of cars and killed. I just think this was, like, the last thing mass transit needed as it's trying to come back.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think anybody who's ridden the subways in New York knows it's a little bit of a claustrophobic experience anyway. Mm. And for somebody who has a little bit of claustrophobia, I'd say, doesn't love crowds and being packed in places, it definitely gives off another negative thing with COVID and this just makes it seem less likely that it's going to bounce back to where it was. But people have said it before, and I think they'll say it again a lot, that New Yorkers are resilient people.
Mm-hmm.
They are the best of us. And
in many ways, yes.
I think we can we'll see them weather this, and hopefully we'll see increased safety measures in the subways and more awareness. And, of course, hopefully this shooter, who seems to have some history of mental illness and some interaction with mental illness treatments in New York, will get the help that he needs and mm-hmm. we'll move forward from this.
The other, I think, big story was the economy, inflation, with a side of Elon Musk, which Leslie and I talked about on Tuesday. But inflation is high. I was reading a lot of articles yesterday about how it's even hitting the grocery store where people try to save money by cooking at home. You are the designated grocery shopper for the Holland family. What are you noticing out there in the aisles?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think the things that you start noticing sort of here and there, oh, that seems higher and that seems higher. And then you see everything seems higher. You know, yesterday I went and got something that's usually $2.99 and it was $3.99. And I went, oh, that's strange. And it was like a generic Kroger brand grocery store product that we buy a lot of. And it was a dollar higher than it had been, you know, almost 25% higher than it had been. And so I don't know if that's transitory or if that's here to stay. But definitely inflation is on everybody's mind. It's a big story. It's something we'll talk about in the next segment, I think, how much that story is affecting the Democratic Party.
Well, so much so the White House seems to be taking a different approach. Like, I talked about this on the news brief. It feels like it's reverse psychology. Like, they went from – it's transitory. It's transitory. This time they were like, y'all, it's going to be so bad. It's going to be the worst, guys. Get ready.
Yeah. I think everybody has abandoned the it's transitory in terms of it's going to go away. It's going to slow down because of the supply chain issues being relieved and things like that. But definitely the messaging was different, which was, we all know it's going to be bad. Be prepared for it to be bad. And so the markets built it in a little bit before it even was announced. And it was right in line with kind of where everybody thought it was going to be. And so, you know, to the extent that the markets tell us anything, it was sort of not news, so to speak, that it was high.
Well, and everybody thinks the Fed should be acting faster and raising interest rates. You, like I said, you work in real estate. Are you noticing anything at your closings? Like, you said yesterday you felt like this year is going to be a weird year for real estate.
Well, I think that absolutely you see the impact on interest rates. I mean, you see, you know, when in mid-pandemic, you saw sort of your 30-year, unheard of interest rates for a 30-year refinance, like below 3%.
We refinanced.
And now you're seeing that come back to sort of reality, which is still low historically, but it feels high to people. It feels – people have this – it's very psychological.
Right, what we always talk about with the economy.
When we first bought a home in D.C., you know, we had – I think it was a 7% rate or a 7.5% rate. And now to get a 7.5% rate, it's almost unthinkable. People would balk at it immediately. But I think we're coming back to that reality here in the next couple of years. You definitely see – those rates creeping up into the fours and the fives, sort of ahead of even what the Fed is doing. Because,
that's
of course,
weird.
The banks have to build in a little bit of, you know, hedge at the end of the day against the reality that it probably will rise. Of course, you're not seeing that on the same side on the savings accounts. So your savings accounts are not increasing in their interest rates at the same rate. But that's capitalism, I guess, for you.
I felt the impact sort of emotionally, especially because we're paying our tax bill and there's all this talk about inflation and it's like unavoidable. The prices are up everywhere and you just start to feel that scarcity, like fear creep into your thinking. And it's unavoidable. I think, you know, no matter how many savings you have or how stable your job is or whatever it is, and it just gives me so much empathy for people who have even less stability, even less sort of cushion than we do. Because if it's affecting me and I'm feeling it and it's stressing me out, I cannot imagine how people sort of on the lower end of the economic spectrum are suffering under this. It's just so stressful. If you're living paycheck to paycheck right now and you're really on the line as far as what you can afford and the prices keep going up and you're everywhere, everything you see is inflation, economy. It's so stressful.
Yeah, and it's cyclical. It feeds itself.
Yeah.
So, you know, concerns about inflation feed inflation. I think there's been a lot of speculation and maybe even some evidence of businesses sort of taking advantage of price, the expectation that prices will increase just to increase prices.
Yeah.
Which the Biden administration is making efforts to try to push back on, but there's only so much that they can do in a free market.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in the next segment for sure. Now, Leslie and I talked about Elon, but now it looks like he's trying to do some sort of takeover of Twitter. Do you want to talk about Elon? How do you feel about Elon? I don't really know how you feel about him as a person.
He confuses me. I don't really know a lot about
Elon.
He's confusing too. I'll be honest with you. I have not studied Elon. We own one of Elon's cars.
We love it.
Elon clearly has a vision for certain things.
Yeah.
I think that it's incredible what he's done with Tesla. It's incredible with what he's done with SpaceX. Those two things. To imagine that this one guy was like, we're going to do these two things, and to drive that as sort of the visionary of it. I wonder if maybe with this Twitter thing, and just so everyone knows the news, like he bought his 9.2% stake, which he again appears to have violated SEC rules when he did.
Word. Made $100 million in the violation.
He has now made a filing with the SEC saying that he has made an offering, a takeover offering, to purchase Twitter, to buy the whole thing.
I feel a little bit like I'm living in an episode of Succession.
At a share premium.
Yeah.
So I think the shares were trading around $45 or $46 at close yesterday.
And but Tesla shares were down.
He's offered $52.40. And on this news, Tesla shares went down. And I was actually thinking about this a little earlier because it reminds me, and some of you may have this experience, there are maybe people in your community who are considered like experts in their field, like the best cardiac surgeon or the best accountant or the best lawyer at XYZ.
Okay.
And then they decide to like open a restaurant.
Yeah.
Right? Or they decide to like open an amusement facility, you know, like an arcade or something.
Yeah.
And
everybody's
everybody's like, well, that's interesting. And like, you really want to think like, well, they're good at something. They're clearly smart. They clearly have a good head on their shoulders. They clearly got some capital. They ought to go out and do that and see what happens. And so frequently, it doesn't last that long.
So
or they sell it to somebody or the next thing happens. So I'm wondering if maybe Elon has sort of bought his own press.
Bless.
Because being a visionary in aeronautics and car manufacturing is one thing, but you have thousands on thousands on thousands of people who actually know what they're doing in those spaces.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure anybody really knows what Twitter could be, can be, ought to be. There's not any subject matter experts who can be like, well, this is how we build a rocket, just like for Twitter, right? So
yeah,
he has his own view of like what Twitter could be. Which I'm a little concerned is too close to what Peter Thiel thinks Facebook should be.
Oh.
Which is like, just open it up. Trump can come back on. Everybody come back on. We'll just pile back in and we'll be a free speech market.
Well, I'll be so mad at Elon if he platforms Trump again.
I don't think that's a bad route.
It reminds me, because I was sitting here thinking, boy, I wonder what Jack thinks about this, Jack Dorsey. And then it sort of opened up this space, this conversation I think I heard on Ezra Klein's podcast with the guy about cryptocurrency. And they were talking about how all these Web 2.0 people are out there in crypto now. And the conversation was like, why? Why? Don't you have enough money? But it's like, it was the YouTube guy was like, well, they just want to build piles. Like, how big can I get the pile, basically? Like, what's the point otherwise, right? Like, what are you doing? Are you trying to make something better? Are you just, because crypto in particular, like, to get the mountains and mountains of money that they consider successful, you have to get it on the ground floor, right? Like, that's, and you get on the ground floor, 400 things, two things hit, and you make just Mount Everest piles of money.
Money, right. I
mean, right.
You make,
so true.
You make digital money, right?
Right.
I mean, it seems very...
But it's just so interesting to me. And that's kind of like, that's sort of what I'm thinking about Elon. Like, but why? Like, what's the point of this? Why don't you, if you want to be a visionary, you know what visionary I'm interested in right now? Mackenzie Scott. That's the visionary I want to see. I want to see who can give it away the fastest, right? Like, not manipulate it into new realms of power or new realms of wealth. Like, let's see, like, that's the visionary action I'm looking for right now.
How are we improving other people's lives
by
buying Twitter and making it more open or letting people buy a check mark or whatever it is he's proposed, which is all sort of all over the map. And it also makes me wonder why he did what he did when he bought this large stake in the company, because he didn't take a seat on the board. And now he's saying publicly, like a week later, well, I don't really feel like I can do enough just in the open, you know, public market.
I only want to be the Elon Musk of Twitter. Like, I don't want to be one of
many. I want to be the big boss of Twitter. I don't want to be just a big shareholder who has a lot of say in what the board does or who's on the board, which is weird. I mean, he's not your Carl Icahn. He's not your, you know, he's not that kind of investor, it wouldn't appear. Or he doesn't want to be, even though he could be. And those guys wield a lot of influence when they have large stakes in companies. And putting people on boards can impact the direction of those companies. But for whatever reason, he doesn't want to do that. He wants to own it or doesn't want a part of it at all. And it's sort of a share manipulation too, because something he said today suggested like, well, if I can't own it, I'm out. Right? So that's, again, we're talking about some very kind of unfortunate and maybe not entirely in the spirit of the law efforts on his part with the shares.
God bless the SEC and their work with this. All right. Next up, Nicholas and I are going to tackle the Democratic Party. We're going to fix it, I think. I feel good about it.
Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible, and skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online. And we were discussing the fact that I am 43, and she said, I cannot believe how young you look. And I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
You know how you learn to really appreciate how good your products are? Leave town and get stuck with whatever shampoo is in the hotel. I take Pros and their custom hair products for granted, y'all. Pros is made for people, not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. From millions of possible formulas, only one is uniquely yours or mine. I never found beauty products that really understood my needs. But ever since I switched to custom hair and skin routine with Pros, I've noticed so many benefits. My thin hair is moisturized but not weighed down, and my waves have never looked better. And Pros isn't just better for you, it's better for the planet. They're a certified B Corp, cruelty-free, and the first and only carbon-neutral custom beauty brand. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/pantsuit. So you get your free consultation, then 50% off at pros.com/pantsuit. That's PROSE.com/pantsuit.
In previous episodes, I have outed myself as a bed-making fanatic. I am very serious about my bed being an oasis, a gift to Chad and me as we crawl into it at the end of a long day. So I want to return to how much I love my Boll & Branch sheets. With Boll & Branch sheets, you can discover a new level of softness. The sheets are made from 100% organic cotton in a buttery, breathable weave that truly gets softer every time you wash them. And you know that I like to do that once a week, so my Boll & Branch are rapidly aging like a fine wine. The sheets look great. I have them in a beautiful slate color. They stay put, so making my bed is quick and easy. They are a bestseller for a reason. The signature sheets feel incredible on night one. They are loved by millions of sleepers, and they come with a 30-night worry-free guarantee. Sleep better at night with the softest sheets from Boll & Branch. Get 15% off your first order when you use promo code PANTSUIT at bollandbranch.com. That's Boll & Branch, B-O-L-L-A-N-D, branch.com, promo code PANTSUIT. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
All right, we went through a couple of topic ideas before we settled on this. We were going to talk about your crush on Sandy. Do you want to just disclose your biases now?
I have, I do like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Or Sandy, as she's known to her friends and family in Nicholas.
I think she's a very interesting political figure. I think the brand that she's built, I think that the platform she's built for herself is in such a short time. And I think that I love that the Republicans all seem to be afraid of her. I think she's, you know, kind of been a really great face for that wing of the party. And if you really watch her public engagement, you know, she's very much still on the ground with her community, with her constituents. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does this stuff, but it's not really a huge part of what the work that she does every day. She's still out there doing, you know, being at union meetings and being at protests and that kind of stuff. I just find her very...
You love her.
I mean, you characterize it as I love her. she's, you know, really captured something, especially in that 2018, I guess was what it was, election cycle that caught on, and she challenged the Democratic establishment and I think made some good changes. And I think, you know, what you see today, I mean, Joe Biden's politics were driven very much now by this progressive wing of the party.
For sure.
And I don't think you would have seen that without AOC and the people that she – the other people who are
the
in the
squad.
Quote-unquote squad, which I don't really like anyway, but
– You don't like the name. It's not that you don't like the people.
Well, I don't like the implication that, like, it's wrong for them to somehow have a cohort of people. I mean, it's always been the case that there have been factions of the party. There's the Blue Dog – I mean, nobody talks about the Blue Dog Democrats in the same – well, it's not nobody, but they don't have that same sort of negative connotation of, like, this is somehow just a clique. They're people who share a common interest and common goals. And,
It is strange. I mean, we're not going to spend the whole time with Sandy, but it is strangely relevant because you are probably more progressive than I am. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So we were going to talk about this sort of debate as we're coming up on the midterms. It seems to just be decided that the Democrats are going to take a beating in November. I am, you know, even though I am more moderate, I am very optimistic. And so I don't ever just sort of accept, oh, we're going to lose everything. You're more pessimistic. It's funny. You're more progressive, but you're more pessimistic when it comes to electoral politics. Maybe that's not funny. Maybe that's probably related.
I think the Democrats will lose seats. Period, full stop. I don't think there's any way they hold them.
Well, it's historical. It's usually the first-term incumbent president loses seats in the midterm. So that's not—
There's a lot of systemic reasons that is the case. There's a lot of reasons—
What are they? Why does that happen every time?
Dissatisfaction. People get dissatisfied. People are dissatisfied almost all the time.
Is it just a come down from the promises of the election? Like, it's just a knee-jerk reaction to you promise the world. When I was thinking about it, I'm like, what if people are just kind of, like, they just hate the presidential campaign season so much that they just, like, they're just so mad. Like, it promises the world. It never delivers. Life goes on. Everything's not fixed. And they're just mad come midterm. I was trying to think about why historically does this happen every time?
I guess there's lots of political scientists out there who could probably try to help you understand that. I think there is some of what you said, which is there's a dissatisfaction with the party in power because not everything is peachy keen. Mm-hmm. There's maybe a sense that party, in some cases, that the party has gone too far. I think that was some of the case in the 2018 election was a sense that Trump had gotten over his handlebars. There was too much going on. They didn't like the tone. So I think, you know, I think the American electorate likes to kind of sway in the wind as far as if everything's not going perfectly well, let's try the other guys, or let's see if a divided government won't work a little bit better. But I think the Democrats, the last two times that this has been a major issue, which would have been in 2000 and the first time that Obama was 2010, right, after the ACA. And now this time, it seems to be sort of the same symptoms or maybe the same causes, which is a sense that they're too focused on an issue that isn't bread and butter enough for a lot of people, you know, or they're too focused on procedural stuff, and they're not really a united front, and there's all this kind of political ugliness, and they just kind of don't like that. They shut it off. So just to say, like with the ACA, obviously important to a lot of people, but you know, they had to do it through reconciliation. There was a lot of storm and drang about, are we going to do this? Are we going to do that? You know, early on it was we're going to do a single payer. That didn't pan out. So then we ended up with this sort of mishmash. There was lawsuits. There was all this other stuff that kind of came out. And I think there was a sense that,
But I feel like the Biden administration really tried to not fall into the trap of the ACA and has delivered. I don't think, you know, I know there's a lot of eye rolling and Nancy Pelosi saying, like, stand on our record. We need to point to our record. But I don't think that's wrong just on paper. They have delivered a lot of things. They finally delivered Infrastructure Week, if nothing else. Like, we have this this generational investment in infrastructure. We have continued COVID investment. I know people would like this last round to go through, but there was, just a massive amount of money poured into investing in testing and investing in the vaccine distribution. We have just historic job growth. I mean, now, I know that is the sort of flip side of inflation, which we're going to get to the part of the record that's more difficult. But, I mean, the job market is hot,
it's
right?
It's very good.
The unemployment is, like, the lowest it's been since, like, something like 1960 or something bananas. And I do think the criticism of the press that, like, they talk about inflation constantly, but they don't ever talk about how good the job market is probably fair. I think the way the Biden administration has handled the invasion of Ukraine has been stellar. Like, now that doesn't necessarily have to do with congressional seats, but it's not unrelated. Congress is passing funding for the Ukrainians as well. So I think the idea that standing on their record is silly is not fair. There is a lot of good record there. I just don't know if that's what connects in congressional races, unfortunately. I think, like, holding up this list of bills is not what connects with people.
Yeah, I guess I would say two things. One, something interesting that I read a lot of places, which is Democrats, when they talk about their record in this last couple of years, they start talking about dollars.
Yeah.
They say it's been $1.5 trillion. We spent however much, right?
Yeah.
And people just go, well, that's just spending.
Right.
They don't relate
that. And if they're worried
that,
about inflation, they're going to say, well, right, that's why we have inflation is because there's been too much government spending.
And they don't relate that to actual potholes being filled, so to speak, or bridges being built. And there is a lot of that going on. But, you know, one interesting thing that I'll just speak from my own experience is, you know, I don't know, about a month or 2 months ago, I got a request for proposal from the State Department of Highways to do legal work, you know, provide rates and everything to do legal work on the Brent Spence Bridge. Like, I receive that because I receive all of them. I'm not – in Western Kentucky, I'm not going to do legal title work for the Brent Spence Bridge in Northern Kentucky. But it's interesting because – that's how you start work when you start doing a bridge. You start talking about, well, what do we need to acquire as the government? What do we need to condemn, you know, to build this bridge? And what legal work do we need to do? And that takes time. That takes months and months. You know, it takes a couple months just to do the RFPs. And then you do the work. And then they actually go out and they purchase the property or they have to go into litigation. So, I mean, people aren't going to see that money on the ground for a while. And what has been top of news is, unfortunately, how are the Democrats not getting along, right? And we can all talk about whose fault is that. Is it the progressives' fault because they wanted to hold up one bill for the other? Is it the moderates' fault because they didn't really keep their end of the bargain, so to speak? I think a lot, you know, we heard so much about Joe Manchin. We heard so much about Kyrsten Sinema. And we didn't hear enough about, we did this good thing. Look, we all got together. We did this good thing. And it's going to be good for America. I think they tried to push that through. But the horse race, quote unquote, story was, the Democrats can't get this done. The Democrats can't get what they really want done, the big piece of this done.
And okay, so, but here's the thing. Here's what sort of bothers me. I feel like it always turns into, well, they won't cover what we've done, which I don't think is unfair. But I also think that there are problematic strategies, messaging coming from the Democratic Party. It's not accurate or realistic to blame every electoral problem the Democrats have on media messaging or even like the sort of unfair and disingenuous messaging of the Republican Party, which I think is there too. Like, I think that that is true too. But, you know, here's where I will, if not throw the progressive wing of the party under the bus, at least offer up some, with love in my heart, criticism. Which is, I think the perception of the Democratic Party, which is fueled by the Republican Party and fueled by media messaging, let me just give that, you know, aside, is also, you know, in some fairness based on progressive messaging around defund the police and, you know, abolish ICE. And I'm not even mad at them. Like, I think we need people pushing the party to the left. I'm so happy that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has pushed the president to the left. I think what bothers me is there's never any sort of goodwill given to the moderates who say, okay, well, we also need people saying that's too far for some people. Like, that's a good conversation to have, but that's too far for the majority of Americans. And if you say that, it's like, well, then you get attacked as, you know, not caring about people or, God forbid, being racist or sexist or whatever, when there's no, I feel like, goodwill of like, this is a conversation. This is a back and forth. You push to the left, I push to the center, we end up where we need to be. And it just feels like the moderates are always villainized. Not that, again, progressives aren't villainized. Lord knows AOC is villainized by every which way, right? But it just feels like we also have to acknowledge that, you know, I think we got out in front of our skis a little bit and that we went further than a lot of the American population is willing to go, including growing segments of the Democratic Party like the Latino coalition, right? Like that Donald Trump increased his vote share with them. There are some incredibly conservative, socially conservative components of the Latino part of the Democratic coalition. And I just think, like, it feels like that gets ignored or sort of pushed aside because it doesn't fit with this narrative we've all agreed on or some of us agreed
on. Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say to that is it's a little bit the same problem that the Republicans have, which is that the base, a big part of the base of the Democratic Party is very progressive, especially in the major cities, especially in pockets of the
Northeast. Is it a big part of the base, or is it just a loud and powerful part of the base?
I don't know. That's my question. But I think that's the same question the Republicans ask.
Right. No, I think that's true.
How big is the Trump part of the base? Well, it's hard to really gauge it, but it's big enough.
Well, and it just – even that part of the conversation bugs me. It's like – because their base is different than our – like, I don't ever want a conversation again comparing, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene's part of the base to AOC's part of the base, because they are so – they do not deserve to be in the same print piece, much less – in the same comparison.
Yeah, but that isn't that driven by some by just your own politics and your own
no.
sort of knowledge base.
Absolutely not.
Okay, fair enough. But I think that to go back to what you said, which is there's bad messaging or there's messaging that breaks through. There has been, I think, and I don't disagree with you, too much of a focus on trying to find a soundbite or a three-word phrase or whatever it is that works and breaks through for the Democrats. And so things like defund the police, which are much more nuanced than just defund the police. You know, obviously Biden in his State of the Union address said, don't defund the police,
fund the police.
But he was trying to say fund them in different ways, fund them in ways that aren't just about enforcement, fund them in ways that are more about community building, fund them in ways that are about mental health engagement, things like that, where, you know, when you just hear defund the police, it's just so easy to twist that to they don't want to patrol people to patrol streets. They want, you know, anarchy. They want whatever it is. And that's obviously not the case, but you can't explain that. Once you've put that into the air,
right.
It's yours. You have to own it. And so if you can't explain it, you know, it doesn't explain what it is. You know,
right.
it explains something different, I think, to most people. And so it's same with abolish ICE. I mean, obviously ICE is a new agency, relatively new agency. And so I think the abolition of ICE is one thing. But, you know, what people really want is change immigration policy. You know, we're too engaged with enforcement and not engaged with, you know, and with the real effects of what that enforcement has caused, which is labor shortages and,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of different things. So I agree with you. I think the messaging has been bad. I think the messaging that's broken through can be damaging, has been damaging. But I think that the reaction to that from the moderate side of the party has been, well, let's just moderate everything. Let's just talk about – let's just all come to the middle and talk about things in the middle. And I don't know that that really is going to win you elections. It's certainly not going to fire up people in the primaries.
Well, it just depends on where you are. It's going to win you elections in some places.
And that's true. And I think that that's what you touch on is that there are definitely a lot of people who gave us the majority in 2018 who now feel like they've been thrown under the bus or they've been abandoned. And Stephanie Murphy, I think, in Florida, she's not running again. She was one of the ones who came in 2018. She is not running again, and she has basically said, it's because I feel like I've been abandoned by the party platform and the party leadership who seem to be okay with primarying people who have won congressional districts with more progressive candidates and not understanding that people like me, and she actually called out Abigail Spanberger, who won by saying, we're going to be in the middle. We're going to take votes that the Democratic Party is not always going to agree on. And then we go and we actually do what we say and people get mad at us.
Yeah.
So the Democratic Party is, I mean, it's a big, big, big tent. And that is part of its
strength
and part of its problem.
Right.
And until they can get their arms around what are they going to – how much leeway are they going to give people to be – different from the expectation of the party leadership.
Well, and I think Nancy Pelosi gives them a lot of leeway. I think she does a good job of protecting moderates, although it's – I mean, maybe Stephanie Murphy would feel something different. But I think historically you see that. And look, here's the thing. You know, if I'm painting with the broadest of broad brushes, I feel like if you are sort of all the way on the right on the Republican Party and you're being fueled by your base, it's like – You can't do anything different because they're terrible. And if you're on the Democratic base, I think there's a little bit of – probably more than a little bit of they're terrible. But there's also like – but we're on the side of right. And so you can't criticize the progressive left or if you're not on the side of right. You don't care about poor people. You don't care about immigrants. You don't care about people of color. That's sort of the pushback. And to me, I don't feel like there's an honest conversation. And I think this is what we get into – with, like, what you see with Donald Trump expanding his vote share. Like, Look, I understand I'm more radical on immigration than most Americans. Like, open borders don't bother me. I get that that is a radical position. But I don't feel like there's an honest conversation among progressives, especially, like, people with those sort of who really want to overhaul immigration and have, like, a really radically different approach to immigration to say, like, please understand that will change the politics of our country. Not everybody who's going to come from Mexico or Honduras is going to be a Democrat, like, is going to be even progressive. Many of those people will be very conservative on abortion, even on immigration policy. And I just feel like that's, like, the thing that you can't say out loud or is sort of ignored or just, like, pretended like that's not going to be an issue to our detriment. Like, I think, like, there's a sense of, especially in the progressive caucus, that, like, if it's the right thing to do, like, if you're a good person, this is what you want. And if you ask about sort of the electoral consequences of that or the electoral strategy surrounding that, like, you, that's just, well, no, it'll work. It's electoral. It's in a winner electorally. Well, maybe where you live, but not everywhere, and definitely not in a presidential race. Like, we've talked about this on Pansy Politics. We're more radical on criminal justice. We're more radical on reproductive rights. We're more radical on immigration than the majority of Americans. And I just feel like that's where the moderates, I think, get frustrated, is like, are we talking about where we should be? Or are we talking about where people are? Because I think that's the conversation that often is missing within, like, sort of the Democratic conversation, that bridge. How do we, that difference between where we want people to be and where they actually are? And are we trying to convince them? Are we trying to just, you know, push and hope they catch up? Like, I feel like that's what gets missed so often.
Well, and I think that you're seeing that tension in a couple of different places right now with the Biden administration. So right now they're talking about ending Title 42. Which is a policy that if you ask the loudest critic of that policy, they would say it was a policy that was bad immigration policy cloaked as public health policy.
Right.
So it was COVID will enter the borders through immigration, and so we're going to close the border because COVID. And now the Biden administration is talking about ending it. And so you have a tension there. You have lots of Democrats who are like Mark Kelly, who is very progressive on most issues, saying, this is really bad for me electorally.
Yeah.
This is really bad for me. Please don't do this. This seems hasty. Yeah, it was bad policy, but it's worse electorally, politically, to end it now. And in particular—
But you're going to have progressives that say, oh, come on, but what Governor Abbott's doing is way worse. Like,
right,
with the Mexican trucks and the—
Right. But I think what you see, some of what you see is COVID politics, which is— Department of Transportation extended the mask mandate on air flights, on airplanes and in airports, which I'm all in favor of. I think we should just do it forever.
No, but we have to fly to Europe, and I do not want to wear a mask.
Everybody can wear a mask on a plane, and that'd be fine. I don't want to breathe your air. But people are saying, like—
But you are more radical than most Americans on that.
Right. But sure, if COVID is over for immigration, why isn't COVID over for us on these airplanes, right? That's kind of, there's that tension. And I think you see that in the energy sector, too, where you have— Biden is announcing, you know, we're going to allow people to have E85, higher ethanol gasoline during the summer months, which has typically been an environmental issue and is getting pushback from progressives like, this is a bad idea. And the messaging is wrong, because the messaging should be, gas is expensive because we haven't moved more quickly to renewables. And that's really should be the messaging, where instead the messaging is, gas is high. We're going to do everything we can to get it down and make this as easy as you can on
pocketbooks. But again, that's where, do we want where people are, or do we want where people should be? That's what's so hard.
Agreed. And that is the tension.
But you can't 100%. Get people to where you want them to be if you lose all the time, right? I think that's where I am that's where my moderate streak comes out is— You can't get people anywhere if you're in the minority all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's so hard. And I mean, look, we're not breaking any new ground here. I know this is what they fight about at those retreats. I know this is on every Democrat's mind. And the truth is, you and I have both been Democrats to know we're never going to be in lockstep like Republicans. That's not who we are.
No,
that's not who we have ever been. And that's okay. I prefer that to the other way. I would absolutely always rather sort of be mad at each other and fighting and mouthing off to the press than to have censures and kicking people out of the party and sort of the approach, the sort of rhino approach of the right now?
Oh, absolutely. I think that I don't think there's any call for blood on any of these people.
No.
I think even AOC would admit.
I love her. I love Sandy.
I understand Joe Manchin. I don't like Joe Manchin. I don't like where he's at with this. I think he's wrong. I think that he underestimates the wisdom of the voters in West Virginia if he was to do this thing and was actually to see the result. But I understand his calculus.
Yeah, but I don't talk – I'm not trying to lecture Joe Manchin on underestimating the wisdom of the West Virginia vote. He knows him better than you and I do.
For sure. But that's what I'm saying. I think ultimately where I come out is if we want to stay in the majority and we want to get good things done, don't let the enemy of – don't let perfect be the enemy of good.
Now, you sound like a moderate there, not a progressive.
Well, you know, sometimes you have to do that.
You did live in Georgia, so there is that.
I mean, yeah. I mean, where I grew up, it was the bluest piece of the state and still is. I mean, I grew up, just for everybody who doesn't know, in DeKalb County, Georgia, which was, you know, got a lot of press when Warnock and what's the fellow's name down there?
John Ossoff.
Sorry, he ran for everything.
I recite them. One, and
that's a big county that gave Joe Biden, that put Joe Biden over the top in Georgia as well. And so it's been interesting growing up there. It was a very, very liberal enclave, and it continues to be a very, very liberal place. Probably more liberal than it was when I was growing up there.
Yeah, for sure.
Also more affluent than it was when I was growing up there. So I've lived in a place where, you know, my politics aren't really necessarily the surrounding areas politics. You know, North Georgia, Southern Georgia, those places were very red and have been for ages. So maybe it's informed by the fact that I know you can't get everything done just by being the raging progressive liberal, but it sure would be nice if you could.
It doesn't stop you from being real mad a lot of times.
It does. I get mad.
You get so mad. You were so mad about the story in the New York Times about the Republicans who killed naming the courthouse after the black judge because he one time put down a legally sound argument about prayer in schools, I believe, was the issue. And it was a Georgia congressman that stopped it all.
Yeah, I don't remember all the details of that story because my eyes started going a little bit.
You were getting a little red.
A
little hot.
The story was basically that, you know, this was a lot of people supported this.
Yeah, it was.
This fairly
anodyne
bill.
It's like the one thing
bill.
They do all the time is name things without.
They were going to name this after the first, I believe, African American Supreme Court justice
in Florida.
They were named a courthouse after him, and one Republican congressman found
from Georgia, wasn't even from Florida.
Found an item in the news from sometime in the late 90s, I think, about how he upheld a ruling that prayer in schools was inappropriate, which is not terribly.
And I just want to say, like, why were you looking for that, sir?
Why was he looking for it?
Yeah, right? Like, what out of everything of this man's biography could have possibly triggered your search through his media clippings? Do you do that for every time they name something? Because you wouldn't do anything else if that's true.
Yeah, it was very, it's a very
racist.
Strange. And then it just became like a self-imposed litmus test. If you read the article, it's almost like people who voted against it didn't know that why they were voting against it.
They just knew Republicans were voting against it.
It was just lockstep.
So gross.
You know, one of the sponsors of the bill said, I had no – it was so confusing. I didn't know what was going on because she thought it was going to be,
it had bipartisan
435
support, yeah.
to zero, and it ended up failing ultimately. So
– and I don't think you'd see a moment like that in the Democratic Party.
I don't know. I mean, I think it just depends. But I think there's a lot of unfortunate things going on.
We don't trust each other enough to do that.
the Republican Party has its own issues. And I, you know, we have had a lot of conversations about the Republican Party, such as it is. And I think you have maybe a little bit more sense that the more moderate wings of the Republican Party act in good faith more than maybe I think they do. Mm-hmm. I think that the moderate wing of the Republican Party takes cover from –
it's not even the honor
radical wing.
There's just
the
a few moderate
Party.
Senators who I will defend. I don't know if there is the moderate wing of the House. I don't see it. So
right, and I think one of the things that we talked about, just so everybody has a little color on this, is that you know there was a lot of during the confirmation hearing, most recent confirmation hearing of soon to be Justice Jackson. She was questioned a lot about her rulings on or her sentencing in child pornography cases. And, when Romney and Collins and Murkowski voted in favor of her confirmation, Marjorie Taylor Greene put out this terrible tweet that said they're basically pedo lovers or something along those lines. It was
pretty. See, aforementioned thing where I said, do not ever compare Marjorie Taylor Greene to AOC.
Right. But at the same time, you know, and then the Republicans all came out and they were all aghast that she would say this. And, you know, that's just that's not where we're at and that's not who we are kind of thing. And I kind of wanted to look at all of them and go, but you guys started this.
Right. You know she talks like that.
You knew this, all this stuff about.
It's fine when she's accusing Democrats
of this. About this judge was in bad faith. You know it was all theater. You know that Marjorie Taylor Greene's staff didn't go out and find all these rulings. She doesn't
right.
probably even have the staff to do it. So it was somebody else's large staff. Well, let's go find dirt.
It was Josh
Let's make
Hawley,
a big
yeah.
stink on it. And then when she does what she naturally does, which is
Escalate.
Take it that next step, you all act like, oh, my goodness. And to me, it just seems craven.
Yeah.
And like, oh, they act all surprised. But they quote unquote, you know, I hate to sound too much like the playground bully, but he started it. Right. Like y'all started this.
Yeah.
And so now it goes so far, you kind of have to own it. And it seems like they try not to own it or understand that this is there.
Well, and it was fascinating to me that, like, the Madison Cawthorn controversy was, like, they finally got mad at somebody because this dude who they know who is young and ridiculous and extreme said, I staff up with communications, not legislative staff. And the thing you finally got mad at is he said something about all of you. Now, he talks this way about Democrats all the time, that he says, you know, that they want to destroy the country, that they're all socialists, like all these ridiculous things. But he implies that you guys do coke and orgies and then let's shut it all down. Like, mm-hmm. I love that it finally came back and hit you a little bit and then you got mad. But that you know how he operates. It's not a secret.
Yeah.
He broadcasts it everywhere that this is the way he talks and the way he acts.
Sure. And let's not go too much down the rabbit hole of the Republican Party, because that's not really what we're supposed to be talking about here. But I encourage you all to look up a recent clip.
Ugh.
I can't remember the fellow's name.
Jonathan Swan.
Jonathan Swan, who we love.
Beth loves him.
Because he asks the hard questions.
He's
he
very
had
prepared,
an interview,
yeah.
a live interview, face-to-face interview with Mitch McConnell, and asked Mitch McConnell some uncomfortable questions about how do you justify the way, you know, how would you say on January 6th, you know, Trump tried to overthrow the government and then 2 weeks later say if he was a Republican nominee, you would vote for him
mm-hmm.
and you would support him. And it's a very uncomfortable situation. And McConnell really avoids the question.
He does. Jonathan Swan did the best job I've ever seen of somebody holding Mitch McConnell to account, who is also very prepared and always like just he just has no problem saying, I'm not going to answer that. No. Like, he just has no scruples when it comes to interviews. But Jonathan Swan was prepared in a way for that, and which everybody should be. It's not like it's a secret that this is how he responds in interviews. But I thought Jonathan Swan did the best, like, was the best prepared and really just kept sticking it to it and sticking into it and sticking into it.
Right. And that's a different question for – or a different conversation for a different day. Should we let people get away with this as much as we seem to let people get away with this, which is to do things that seem – contradictory and even to some degree craven and just look the other way and go, well, that's just the way that it's always been done. And that's Mitch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we got way off topic there a little bit. But
Democrats
and Republicans have, I think, similar problems. I think the Republicans' problems are probably.
I disagree. I do not think we have similar problems.
Okay. Well, we can agree to disagree.
Ugh, we hate that phrase at Pansy Politics. You're not going to get invited back. You keep that up. No, I don't think it's the same. I think what the Republican Party and the way they handle dissension is why their party is in such terrible state right now. And our party, we might take a schlacking in the midterms, but I don't look at the Democratic Party and think, oh, my gosh, we're just in terror. We're in a terrible state. We're where we always are, which is fighting, disagreeing. But that's what we advocate here on Pansy Politics, right, is that there should always be conversation. There should be give and take. We don't bury our disagreements. We don't silence dissent. We, you know, work it out. And it might not always be the best electoral strategy, for sure. And arguably that is what a party is supposed to do, is win elections. But I'm still, like, so proud to be a Democrat. Absolutely.
Sure. And I'm still hopeful about Democrats. And I think, you know, I think that some of this, too, is just generational.
Yeah. And they I mean, it's like your mama. It's my mama since I was 18. I can talk about her. Nobody else can, but I can.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're perfect, but I'm definitely still happy to be a member of the Democratic Party.
So official policy is we're not perfect, but we're better than the other guy.
Well, that is usually the policy in a political party.
looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life, Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. You guys, I love my Aura frames. I have one in my office. I have one in my kitchen. I have given one as a housewarming gift. I have given one as Mother's Day, Father's Day. They are the most amazing gifts because this app is a game changer, in my personal opinion, in digital frames. It makes it so, so easy to get the pictures on there and even videos. It plays like you're in Harry Potter, you guys. It is the best. I love mine so much. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Nicholas, we just returned from spring break.
We did.
We went to Utah.
The last time we did this, I guess it was spring break.
Right? Yeah. Have we just gotten back?
We've just gotten back from the Everglades and
we talked about the parks for the main segment.
That was right. Yes.
Because we are park people. We are attempting to visit every national park before we retire. We're making really good progress. We've been through like 13 in the last year.
We have. I think picked a lot of the low-hanging fruit in terms
it's
of
true.
Geographically.
I think we should just basically move to Alaska for a month because you can only drive to like two of the six in Alaska. And you have to take planes. So that's the Mount Everest of the situation. But right now we went through Utah. You can see five national parks in the state of Utah: Arches, Canyonlands, Capitol Reef, Bryce Canyon, and Zion. We saw them all in a week. And with really not that much driving. The driving was not
bad. It was 10-ish days, right? I mean, it was a week plus.
Yeah, that's true. Because we left on Thursday. No, we left on Friday and got back Saturday.
So we did about a day and a half in each park. And they really are geographically not that far away. Arches and Canyonlands are literally 30 minutes away.
Yeah.
I think it's another 3 hours drive to Capitol Reef, two and a half hours down to Bryce Canyon. Bryce Canyon and Zion's about an hour and a half, 2 hours. So we didn't do a ton of driving. The last trip we did to national parks, we did a lot more driving.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about some of the choices we made on this trip, just so Nicholas can bring up his ham radio, which is what he wanted to talk about outside politics. And I said, no, y'all are welcome.
I didn't have a ham radio. I had one, but I wasn't using it. But one of the things that you will find in a lot of these parks, which isn't surprising after you've been to a couple of them, is that the cell service is
not great.
Pitiful.
I mean, Utah has so many things. Reliable cell service, not one of them.
Or non-existent. And we were traveling with Sarah's parents. They were traveling in a separate car from us, which was a lifesaver sometimes. It was very helpful to split up groups, to
he means set up siblings, so they
weren't
fighting.
Lower the sibling rivalry during longer stretches of the trip. And we had a couple of what are called GMRS or FRS radios, which is
commonly known as walkie-talkies.
Commonly known as walkie-talkies, but some of them are required to have a license for, you know, do your own research.
Oh, my gosh.
But They were very, very, very helpful, I think. I mean, at the end of
many times I heard, aren't you glad I brought these walkie-talkies?
I like some credit, as do you.
I do. So I like credit.
Everybody likes a little credit. And the walkie-talkies were helpful because when we didn't have cell service and couldn't text each other, we had, you know, a walkie-talkie to say, hey, we're going to pull over here. People are hungry. Are you guys hungry? Do you need a rest stop? Just to have that immediate and not have to, you know, are they going to pick up? Are they not going to pick up? Was nice. And I think, you know, in the future, we'll probably even have them when we expect cell service to be decent if we're traveling caravan style.
Let's go to the important part where I get credit for planning this amazing trip.
Yeah, you do an incredible job of planning these things. And so just so you know, understand sort of the separation of the planning. Sarah does all the hard work.
True.
And then she says, what hikes do we need to do?
Yeah. That's accurate.
So Sarah finds the hotels. She does the reservations. She
does flights.
She finds the flights.
Most of the restaurants.
Most of the restaurants, that kind of stuff. She crowdsources from you guys.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Lots of helpful.
I'm supposed to begin. I want to talk about my process.
Right. So go ahead.
So when everybody's like, how do you do this? It literally is my full-time job. Not really, but it feels like that. For like when I'm really in it, I'm not like reading for pleasure. I'm not watching TV. It's what I'm doing with my extra hours in the day. This one wasn't as bad because it's like a known road trip. So most people will tell you, like, you can either fly into Vegas, go up to Salt Lake, fly in and out of Vegas, or fly in and out of Salt Lake. So that's what we did. So there was lots of like road trip itineraries. The one I did in the Pacific Northwest was harder because there wasn't the exact trip I wanted to take. So I kind of had to plan it myself. Our trip in Europe is hard, but it's also easier because you just do what Rick Steves tells you to do, which is my approach to Europe. Just buy the Rick Steves book and just do what he tells you to do. But for this one, it wasn't that bad. Mainly because once I get the loose itinerary of where we'll be day by day, then I just crowdsource and y'all send me prolific lists of restaurants. And especially if a restaurant comes up over and over and over and over again, that's the one we go to. And that worked out beautifully. I will say this about Utah. Which, to be honest, I did not expect to have good food. Like, I didn't expect to have bad food, but I didn't expect to have, like, food experiences. But we did.
I will say that Utah's food experiences is a credit to immigration in this country.
Word.
Because one of the greatest things we had, or probably the best thing that I remember, something that I would literally fly back for just to eat again.
True.
Was at Ruska's Kolaches, which is there's one in Provo. I think there's a couple more.
Yeah.
And they had a
Carnitas
Kolache.
Ugh.
And it was the most delicious thing.
Why did we only buy one? We should have waited in line and got another one.
Those are from the Czech Republic, and we had
curry pizza.
We had curry pizza. We had
amazing Mexican.
We had, it sounds rote, but good Italian. So it was really a tour of Utah's.
It was so good.
Cuisine, and it was very good.
Yeah.
And we also went to a few just American, all-American hamburger diners. They were good. We had American Indian food the first night we were there. Black Sheep Cafe, right?
Yep.
Isn't that what that was?
Yep.
And so we had a really good food tour.
It was so good. And it just is the most beautiful state. Like I had, you know, I've been out west. My dad lives in California. And when I first started visiting him when I was really little, he lived in Arizona. So it's not like I haven't been out west before. But I had not been to – we've been to the Grand Canyon when the boys were little, just sort of for a quick trip. But I had not been to, you know, Utah before and seen these – I mean, just they're rocks. I do feel like a geologist now. I feel like I can tell you all about the different layers and how the arches are formed. Mad shout out to the listener who suggested Gypsy Guide. Oh, my God. It was so awesome. It's like it picks up your GPS and it plays along with wherever you're driving in the park and it tells you. He gave us an acronym, Oh What Mighty Rocks We Have Seen, that tells you all the layers.
I think it's Oh What Mighty Cliffs
We Have Known.
We know now.
We know now. See, whatever. But to tell you all the like white stone and what was the M1? I like that word.
You got me.
Dang it.
We were experts. We were geological experts.
And so we flew home and slept in our own houses.
Yes, but that's GYPSY. So like GPS with two Ys between one and the G.
Yeah, it was really great. It was a really great tool. We'll be using that in all our parks. Our kids did not love it, but that's okay because they don't pay for anything, so they don't get a boat.
Yeah, I think it was really just the preteen who decided he didn't like it.
And then the other two picked
poisoned
up on
the well of
poisoned
whether
the well,
or not
so true.
He would like it. But he was very interesting. It's based on your GPS. So as you drive.
It's so cool.
And you hit a GPS point, he starts talking about whatever it is you're looking at or getting ready to look at. And it really did take a lot of the load off of figuring out, well, what do we need to go see in this park? we didn't have it until we got to Arches already. One of the listeners advised us about it. And
it was Kathleen. Kathleen is the one who told us about it.
Yeah, and it was great. It was really super, super duper helpful because we just, at that point, like Sarah said, we just kind of did what he told us. Kind of like Rick Steves in Europe. We just did what this guy told us to do. Mm-hmm. He gave tips on parking in Zion. He gave tips on what to do in Bryce first, you know, what hikes to do in Bryce. And I do kind of the what hikes are we going to do. And my process is I look at guidebooks. I try to see, you know, what's going to fit in our physical ability level, which is usually moderate to moderate strenuous. We don't do anything crazy.
We do not do Angel's Landing.
But we try not to just do just
because you don't like heights.
Right. So the other thing that you mentioned Angel's Landing is in two of the parks, there are some reservation systems. So Arches National Park has a reservation system. If you want to get in the park on a certain day, you have to have a reservation. So
we were like probably the first reservation. We had it at 6 a.m. the first day they did it.
We were among the first reservations for sure. We had a reservation for April 3rd, and it was like a 6 a.m. reservation, and I think we were probably the first 15. And you have an hour to enter the park. Once you've done that, once you've entered the park that hour, you can come and go from the park anytime you want to.
So you can go back to bed and then come back.
If you get a 6 a.m. reservation, you can send an unlucky soul to go check you guys in, come back and sleep for a couple hours, and then you guys can re-enter the park if that's what you want to do. We just went on and did the Delicate Arch Trail. And actually, we didn't re-enter the park after that. We had done a half a day before. And so then we went on to Canyonlands after we finished Delicate Arch.
We had a fantastic time. I would highly recommend this trip.
And the other reservation system is for Angel's Landing. Angel's Landing is not for the faint of heart. It is a very high, very steep.
You have to, like, hold onto a chain.
On both sides near the end, it is basically a drop-off. And there is a chain system, which is basically like a handrail, so to speak. Sarah will tell you, I am not good with heights.
He didn't even climb over the big rocks to get to Delicate Arch.
Don't love heights. And I really don't love heights when kids are involved because they're all over the place and they're precious cargo. So I didn't go over to Delicate Arch and I would not try Angel's Landing. But if you are inclined to do so, you are required to have a reservation now to try Angel's Landing because it was getting so crowded, they were worried more people were going to get injured. And there have been people who have fallen to their demise there. So lovely.
I was going to say, what a note to end on. What the heck?
But do go to the Utah parks. It is incredible country. It's hard. I mean, coming from the Southeast, living my entire life in the Southeast and Mid-Atlantic, it's just
they're so big. The rocks are so big, you guys.
The geography out there is unbelievable. And
makes you feel so
small.
Wide
open country and the ranges and the buffalo. And it just doesn't seem like it should all be in one big country. But it is.
Yeah. We loved it. What's going to be our next one, we think?
We talked about doing Texas, doing Big Bend. And
Guadalupe,
that little thing, but piece. That's still a lot of driving. Mm-hmm. We'll probably hit some of the ones that are over closer to us.
You want
to
do Yosemite?
That's not closer to us, but like Cuyahoga will be probably next.
That's maybe an easy
Isle
one.
Royale, Voyageurs in Minnesota. We still haven't done Congaree in South Carolina. So there's a few we could probably still pick up.
I want to hear from any of y'all who've done all the ones in Alaska. I need to hear from somebody that's done all the ones in Alaska.
How do you even do it?
I don't know.
Is one of you a pilot? And so you just rent a boat plane and fly around for a couple weeks? Because that's what we talked about. We're like, well, who do we know that's a pilot?
We'll just take them with us.
That's what we'll do. You know, that seems reasonable and likely within our price range. Not really.
Oh, well, I love traveling with you, hon. It's fun.
Well, you make it easy.
Thanks.
You plan so well.
Thanks for coming on Pantsuit Politics.
Sure thing. I know that I didn't come anywhere close to filling Beth's shoes here, but hopefully you all enjoyed.
We will be back together, me and Beth, next week. So exciting. So we hope that you guys will tune in. And until then, have the best weekend available to you.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production. Elise Knapp is our managing director.
Maggie Penton is our community engagement manager. Dante Lima is the composer and performer of our theme music.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers.
Martha Brunitsky.
Linda Daniel.
Allie Edwards.
Janice Elliott.
Sarah Greenup.
Julie Haller.
Helen Handley.
Tiffany Hassler.
Emily Holiday.
Katie Johnson.
Katina Zuganellis-Kasling.
Barry Kaufman.
Molly Kors.
The Creeps.
Lori Ladau.
Lily McClure.
Emily Neasley.
The Hesitants.
Evans.
Tawny Peterson.
Tracy Putoff.
Sarah Ralph.
Jeremy Sequoia.
Katie Steigers.
Karen True.
Annika Uvaline.
Nick and Elisa Vallelli.
Katherine Vollmer.
Amy Whited.
Jeff Davis. Melinda Johnston. Ashley Thompson. Michelle Wood. Joshua Allen. Morgan McHugh. Nicole Berkless. Paula Bremer. And Tim Miller.
As you have just heard, I'm here with my husband. Cookie, stop. You can't pet her. She wants to be in here, but you can't pet her.
Sorry.
Because you'll hear her licking.
This is getting weird.
Okay, sorry. You can't laugh. Be quiet.